The Athletic.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is showtime. Please welcome the team of the Fulhamish podcast.
It's the Fulhamish podcast, your independent voice of Fulham FC, brought to you by The Athletic UK. My name's Sammy James and welcome to the podcast today. It is the Thursday Club back with you and we're going to be looking at Fulham's last gasp draw at Arsenal. I say it like Fulham were the team that got the point late on. It very much wasn't the case. Four games in a row where Fulham have cost themselves points late on. We're going to analyse that one and just ask why Fulham seem to fold late on in games. It's a pretty depressing situation, which I'm sure you're fully aware of right now. Also, we're going to discuss the European Super League, but we're going to ask the question, would Fulham have said yes? It's a big question. I know some of you have been discussing it on Twitter this week. Would the Khans have jumped at the opportunity to join the now kind of infamous ESL? We'll discuss that later in the pod. As I said, it's the Thursday Club today, so I've got Fulham's writer for The Athletic, Peter Rutzler.
Hello, Sammy. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. And as ever, Jack Collins.
Hello, listeners. Hello, Sammy. Hello, Peter. How are we doing?
Good, thank you. Sporting a wonderful red and black Fulham GMB shirt today, Jack. You've often got good Fulham clobber on, but I think that might be my favourite of your collection.
I think this might be my favourite too. I wrote an article recently for the Football Shirt Collective and they asked me what my favourite shirt was. And it was this and the sort of 92-93 Fiorentina. These are my favourite pieces. But this was given to me by my uncle, which is always nice. It's one of those shirts that feels right. And I wanted to wear it to Wembley, but it was white wool. So I was like, oh, I'm going to have to wear something different. But yeah, probably my favourite piece of the lot.
Just before we start, just to say that you can get The Athletic for £1 a week if you go to theathletic.com/Fulham pod. And Peter, the coverage this week on the ESL has very much dominated the chat. We'll come on to some of the Arsenal stuff later. I think we should start with some of this ESL stuff. It has been a mad week in football. And for once, Fulham doesn't feel like at the epicentre of all our thoughts when it comes to football this week. But of course, they were one of the 14 clubs that came out in the Premier League and denounced the whole thing. It's all fallen in flames. And Twitter gets a lot of stick, but this week has been a goldmine of content.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I mean, normally not much of a fan of Twitter myself, but it was just electric. I mean, even just from a news perspective as well, just how fast things were moving, how broad and how many different, you know, people it brought into the equation, you know, all factors of society. We even had the royal family coming out and condemning it. Like it was crazy. It was a crazy, crazy few days. And obviously there's still much more to come in terms of the fallout and the repercussions for the clubs, which I'm sure we can talk about later in the pod. But it's been a dramatic few days, quite extraordinary, really. I don't think we'll see something quite like this for a while, you know. And it was such a shock that this thing that everyone's sort of been talked about, this sort of what was seen as sort of a paper tiger for so long, has suddenly just come out and of nowhere in the middle of the season and dropped onto all of us. Thankfully, it looks like it's not going to go ahead in any form now with everyone withdrawing. So, yeah, crazy, crazy few days. And great to happen, of course, with, you know, from a Fulham perspective, you're standing from the sidelines. But, you know, in the week where I'm moving flat, I think you're moving house, it's been busy.
I mean, Jack, what we can be always thankful for is that our friends up the road saved football, didn't they? They were the ones that broke it all apart, and we can forever be thankful to Roman Abramovich and his morally beautiful team for saving football for us. We will forever
saviors.
Be in their debt.
The great saviours. We must thank them. Look, I mean, let's not get it twisted. Like, the protest at Stamford Bridge was excellent and was, you know, a part of the, I think, driving force behind this. I don't think it was the driving force. I think someone compared this to a bank robbery, right? It's 12 blokes about to get ballied up outside a bank. And their family are all around them pleading, And like, don't do this, don't do this. And it's like, oh, the family caused this. But actually what they're not talking about is the fact that there were cameras on them and the news networks going, if you rob that bank, you're going to be arrested. And it's nice to say like, oh yeah, it was the family input that really changed their minds. And maybe it was. And I do think that football fans, you know, as a collective this week have been absolutely brilliant. And it was, you know, a united front in so many ways. It was what people talk about, that kind of put aside the tribal differences for a second and deal with it and try not to get into the one-upmanship and the divide. And look, there's always going to be an element of that, isn't there? There's always going to be like, my club pulled out before your club. But there is kind of a sense that everyone got the job done this week, came together and managed to at least make people question themselves, whether that is the defining blow, whether it's the players coming out, whether it's UEFA being like, well, what are you going to do? Because you're not going to be able to be represented in any of our competitions. You know, all of those things together are, you know, are, I think, cause this to fold on itself. But no one should underestimate the work that fans had.
Yeah, I mean, completely. And Jack, I guess I saw you posting something from Versus earlier, which was talking about ways that fans can pick up on the success of kind of destroying the ESL within 48 hours and what else can be fixed in the game, from fan ownership to ticket prices, and most importantly, I think, to the stain that racism has on our game. And I guess from mine and your perspective is that we have been here before from a Fulham perspective with ticket prices. And whilst that was very much a Fulham issue, that is also a wider football issue. And, you know, we found that Fulham fans did mostly come together for the protest that we did a few years ago against ticket prices. And Fulham fans have been famous for doing protests over the years, back to the cottage, no to Fulham Park Rangers. And I guess this is once again a reminder that fan power is important. And whenever we feel to ourselves that actually fans have absolutely no influence in this game, we do. We just have to be mobilized and we have to be prepared to fight for the things in this game that we no longer want.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, we've done ticket prices. That is a stain that's not going away. I think you're right. I think if we could harness this energy to try and genuinely eradicate the racial abuse that goes through this game, if we can take that and be like, look, if you can sanction clubs for leaving and sanction players for leaving a tournament, how come we can't have, you know, lifetime bans, UEFA competition bans for players who are found to racially abuse others? Why are people getting 10 game ban minimums, you know, and not being able to roll back with them? Why are clubs not being deducted? Why are clubs not being thrown out of Europe? Why are fans not getting lifetime bans? And if we can harness that energy for something that's not only a stain on the game, but a stain on society, then I think that would be a force for good next. But you're right, it shouldn't stop here in any sense of football. Kickoff times, you know, equal funding and visibility for the women's game to drive that up and to drive it into a new era, given that it was banned for 50 years and we're still feeling the repercussions of that. The fact that, you know, we look at things like Harvey Elliott and the tribunal process for that and why clubs aren't rewarded for bringing through talent, that needs a look. I think the, you know, TV rights and broadcast deals need a look in terms of distribution and how that pans out across the whole pyramid. There's so much more to this than, you know, just getting rid of the Super League. And it's easy to say, oh, we won, we saved football. And I know that a lot of that was done slightly tongue in cheek, but I do think there's a point where this might be the high watermark. This might be the point where the tide rolled back a little bit. And if we can use that energy and use that kind of design, look, the UEFA's Champions League reform isn't great. Like, let's make no bones about this, right? It's not, oh, we killed the monster and let's leave the devil. It's, you know, you got to look at all of these different elements of things and try and change them for what people want to watch and what people want to see and benefiting the game for fans of it rather than executives. And once that happens, and once we can start to direct this fury continuously at problems that still exist, I think we'll have a better game.
I think one of the things that really doesn't sit right about some of this whole process is how UEFA and FIFA have sort of adopted a position where they feel like they're in the vanguard and leading the good guys, and, you know, they're on the right side of things. And when, you know, for so long they've overseen an organization that has been, you know, shambolic, to be truthful. I mean, we've got a World Cup coming up in 2022 in Qatar, where the construction of these stadiums have resulted in the deaths of many, many workers. And that's the point. And Jack sort of raises it there. I think it's been fantastic the way everyone's come together. And it just shows the power and the influence that football supporters have on their own game. And, you know, it'd be fantastic if that energy could be turned to these other key issues and that it could be a driver for further change, because there are major issues that haven't been addressed and that need to be addressed going forward.
100%. And just thought I'd raise a point from, I was reading Football 365's winners and losers yesterday from this saga. And one of them was Alexander Seferin and UEFA. And it was like, look, for now we hold our nose and go into battle alongside the lesser of two evils, because my enemy's enemy is my friend. Yes, it's galling to hear Seferin talking like him and UEFA, the fan's friend who only wants what's best for the little people. But we can hold feet to the fire later. And then I thought that was important. It was like UEFA is strengthened by this. They have to take that strength and now push it back towards the clubs who were, you know, the fact that this Swiss format has come in is by the big, the biggest clubs, these big 12, the dirty dozen, as many are calling them, who were twisting their arm in order to get coefficients into the Champions League. And, right, and they bowed to those reforms because they thought that was the way to appease those clubs. Those clubs weren't appeased. They went rogue anyway, and now have been kicked back. And there is a point moment now where UEFA can go, hang on. All right, you wanted that. We gave you that. You didn't accept it. You walked off. We're taking back the things we gave you. We're taking back the concessions we made because you've thrown those concessions in our face. And I think that has to be the next step.
Yeah, 100%. That was the thing for me. And I think what perturbed football fans the most was the fact that the order of merit that football works on, the pyramid, was under threat. And it's such a mad thing, right? There are so many powers in the game that keeps the rich at the top and stops the lower teams ever. Can you actually imagine Fulham winning the Premier League in your lifetime, Jack?
Yeah, 100%. Why not?
Can you actually, though, in seriousness?
Well, no, Sammy, I can't. But at the same time, if you'd asked me in 1998, when we were floundering, at the, yes, we were doing okay. We would know that we'd get to a European final. I probably would have said to you no. So, like, things can change quite quickly in the game.
But my point is that I guess what it killed was fans' ability to dream, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It killed the ability that one day, you never know. I don't ever think Fulham will win the Premier League in my lifetime, sadly. I don't think Fulham will qualify for the Champions League in the next generation. But one day, Fulham might do a Leicester City or might do another European run. And what this Super League would have done was kill that for fans like us and kill it for fans of Swindon Town or of Huddersfield, right? That they one day might be able to go to the top of the game.
And again, in Huddersfield's case, we'll just caveat
well,
that.
Yes, yeah. But I guess that was what was so perturbing for so many football fans was the fact that you could no longer dream.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. That's it. It's the ability to rise up and down on merit. Look, do I think it's going to change a whole lot? Do I think if you had a Super League format in the Champions League, right, and It was 12 teams from across Europe who earned their place at the top and they were only going to have 12 teams in it. I don't think people would be that perturbed. I don't think people would be like, nope, we're not doing that. We're actually making the Champions League smaller is a terrible idea. I don't necessarily think it is. Like, conceptually, the actual system and structure of a Super League, it was fine. I don't personally like it because I'm a Europa League ultra, as you know, but like I do think it's fine. If that's what you want the Champions League to look like, then fine. As long as it's on merit, that's your call. Like, you can have your own opinions about whether that is. What I think galls people is not only the audacity of people to be like, no, we deserve a spot at the table for the next 30 years. And I said last night to someone on Twitter, in the 80s, the Super League would have had Nottingham Forest. It would have had Hamburg. It would have had, Steaua Bucharest. And now those teams aren't anywhere near what it's Super League. So the goal to be like, no, we're going to be there for the next 30 years. We will. No doubt about it. It was almost, on top of the fact that Tottenham and Arsenal aren't there now. There's so much been said about American owners and the fact that the Glazers drove this and John Henry and not understanding the concepts of the English game. I think what upset me the most was Perez and Agnelli, because theoretically they should understand. They've grown up in the systems that they went to. And Agnelli said a comment, I think, when he went into the Serie A meeting, and they said, if you do this, they'll only these three teams will win the Serie A for the next 80 years. And he went, well, they have already. I said, no, they haven't. Like, tell that to any of the teams that, you know, that have won, own a Scudetto. You know, Hellas Verona have a Scudetto. Like, tell them that. But also, it's Atalanta beat Juventus at the weekend. And Agnelli has said in the past, he's like, is it right that Atalanta should get into the Champions League based on one good season? He'll be like, yes, of course it's right. That's how football works. Like, that's how sport works. The point is, you do well and you are rewarded for it. And to take that away just seems so like, and you know, an antithesis to the actual spirit of the game. And I think that's what wound me and a lot of fans up the most.
Well, bring me on nicely to our American owners, Peter, and the Khans. There was a great piece in The Athletic this morning by Stu James, which was trying to work out whether the other kind of 13, 14 clubs in the Premier League would have said yes to the offer of a Super League had it been offered to them. And you saw inconsistencies in maybe the words of Steve Parish, who's been the Crystal Palace chairman, who's been massively in the media over the last few days against the ESL, yet only a few months ago was wondering why the Premier League should be propping up the EFL earlier in the pandemic, where we had all of those problems and whether the Premier League would kind of trickle down the money to the Football League. And we have American owners. We have owners that are in the NFL system, almost exactly what the Super League kind of wanted to replicate itself on. No relegation, no promotion, the same 32 teams season after season. And I guess the question is, we'll never know, but we can debate it. Would Shahid Khan have been tempted by this offer?
It's a really good question. It's an interesting question. And I don't think it's one we could ever probably know the answer to, because without Fulham actually being in that position. And I think when you look at it, I think any club in the Premier League, if they're in the top six or in this so-called big six, or claim to be, as seeing as some aren't actually in the top six at the moment, I think they would be sort of taken by this idea. I think from a financial standpoint, they would be. But as you mentioned, you know, Shahid Khan and the Khans, they own and run the Jacksonville Jaguars. So the American system of a closed shop is not unfamiliar. And also, as Jack mentioned, you know, it was the American owners that were driving it. You know, Joel Glazer was the name on every statement, and a Glazer statement on the Liverpool website. I mean, it's just extraordinary. But you know, it was John Henry, it was Stan Kroenke, it was Joel Glazer who seemed to be the key proponents of it from a British football side. So it does raise the question: an American owner at Fulham, would they follow the same way? What I think, when you look at Shahid Khan and the way he sort of conducted, the way he speaks, there is a difference, I feel, between how Shahid Khan operates and those American owners. They are very much backseat operators. You don't hear from them. They never front up. They never speak publicly, which you don't get with Shahid Khan. He does speak publicly. And yes, you could point to the PR side, but it's clearly something he wants. He wants his voice out there. And that is quite a stark contrast in that sense. But you know, I mean, when you look at the Premier League as a whole and in terms of how they think and how they work, I mean, you only have to look at the pay-per-view system, which was voted through by the 19 clubs. It was only Leicester City that didn't voice their opposition to it, which would suggest that when it comes to improving revenues, they're more than happy to do so without necessarily considering the wider whole. But if for instance, Fulham did want to do that, say they were top four, for a sustained period and decided they were Super League worthy, it would end up being rank hypocrisy. I mean, you look at what Shahid Khan said about Project Big Picture and his programme notes. He spoke about the importance of ambition and the importance of the pyramid and how it would run counter to his own values about, you know, his own backstory of with Flex and Gate and going from relatively nothing to building up a huge multi-billion pound empire. So from that, I think there's two ways to look at it, but you know, it's very, very interesting. And because of the American side, you think maybe they could, but it would certainly be contrary to the way he's presented himself anyway.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think it's easy to say, you know, he sits around the table on the NFL board with Kroenke and Glazer and John Henry and all of these already. But I think it's also important to factor that Stan Kroenke and Shahid Khan had a falling out over the attempted purchase of the St. Louis Rams years ago. And then I don't think that's ever been forgotten. Obviously, he went on and bought the Jags instead. But that was, you know, something that, that happened. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Kroenke blocked Shard from purchasing the controlling stake in the Rams, and then obviously moved them to LA instead, and off they went. And that was a different analogy. But it is something that, that kind of struck me, that I thought maybe wouldn't, maybe doesn't play ball quite as much as we think with the other owners, it, just because of that. Because the NFL has always felt like a bit of an old boys club. And I think that there's maybe that kind of slight jar because of what happened there, perhaps, and therefore maybe it is one of those where he was like, no, I won't back your scheme. But as Peter says, obviously the PPV thing went through. Obviously there's questions over Project Big Picture and all of those things. So I like to think the answer is actually no. I like to think the answer is they wouldn't buy into this. But I mean, there was also, you know, there's also that always that thought of how many clubs have the financial capability to say no to something like this. I think PSG have stayed out of it because they have the World Cup to think about, and it would have been just too much of a mess. I think Bayern stayed out of it, and Dortmund did, because their fans, you know, the 50+1, the backlash, it would have been just too much for the club to suck up. And I think that you look at the rest of the clubs, and Leipzig, Sevilla, Porto, and I do question whether they were actually invited. Much as I'd like to think this was something done on merit, I somehow don't believe it. And I don't believe that Florentino Perez has looked at those clubs and gone, yeah, they want to be part of my, I want them to be part of my network. I don't think so. So I suppose it is how much financial capacity have you got to turn this down? And the only teams that I think really would have, PSG obviously, and Bayern, almost flayed by the fact that they were like, the fans will just kill us, so we just can't. So that leaves a question open, I think.
I think one other thing as well, I think if Shahid Khan was into this, it come into football on the basis of trying to improve his revenues and everything like that, he wouldn't be investing in a club like Fulham, I don't think. You know, I mean, as much as, you know, Fulham have a very proud history, they're not at the top end of the football pyramid. I think we all know that. And, you know, when if you're going into a Liverpool or a Manchester City, well, not Manchester City per se, but,
a legacy club,
what a dreadful word. You know, there is a big, big difference there. And I think that also speaks for itself. And it's also worth pointing out that Shahid Khan was one of the first to come out and criticise it. You know, there were conversations on Monday once America had woken up to the news and that this was definitely happening. And, you know, he came out with a statement, which was late Monday night our time. So, and then a lot of the other clubs followed suit the next day. So, you know, it's we can only guess, really.
Yeah, I mean, the statement that Shahid Khan put on the website, it didn't say too much that you wouldn't expect, but the sentence that is interesting, he said, the concept will not serve the game or our most important stakeholders, the generations of football fans here in England. I guess on one hand, I'm cynical because of everything that happened with the ticket prices, the fact that Fulham voted for pay-per-view, which goes against the thing that you'd like to think, that Shahid Khan has always said he's a custodian of this football club. But then some of those actions have gone against what you would think a custodian of a football club would do. But I think what probably makes you guys right is the fact that I think that Shahid is more PR savvy than those other owners that you mentioned. And I think Shahid Khan would have known that this would get a negative reaction and therefore wouldn't have done it on that basis. Whether he actually would have done it because he didn't believe in the kind of like killing the game, I'm not sure he really cares that much about that, but he would have known the negative reaction that this was going to provide. And I think he has a PR team who are wise to what this reaction would have been. But as you say, Peter, the Glazers, FSG, I just think we're living in a bubble, a Zoom bubble, as I've seen it called in several columns this week, that they just didn't realise what real fans thought.
Well, Ed Woodward's PR guy was Neil Ashton. Like, if anyone should have been able to foresee this coming, it should have been him. Like, he's been involved in the game for donkeys. Like, as if he thought, yeah, this is a really good idea. And maybe he did. Maybe he did say to them, this is going to be an absolute shit show. And And instead, they were just like, nah, I'll be fine. So, you know, there is that element of it that PR teams could have come out and been like, lads, this is really not going to go down well. And they've just gone, yeah, nah, be fine, though. In a couple of weeks, the storm will blow over and people will just get on with it. And I think that was kind of the attitude, to be honest. I think it was like, there is going to be a backlash. We'll just weather that. It's going to be rubbish for a bit. We'll weather it. And then eventually people, they might boycott even the first season of it. But eventually people will just start coming back. And I think that's, it's a dangerous attitude, isn't it? Because it's almost certainly true.
I think one of the key things was the fact that, you know, I don't think they would have countenanced on the government coming out so strongly against it. And, you know, I think you saw that with Manchester City, and there's been, you know, talk of how the Abu Dhabi government did not want some kind of diplomatic dispute with the British government over this. And then suddenly it's taking on a whole new realm of problems that probably they didn't foresee. And you could definitely say there's some naivety in that. But again, it does come back to the strength of the backlash, because without that strength of the backlash, you don't get a response from the high levels.
I think what I was pleasantly surprised by was the reaction of some in the media. I really thought that quite a lot of people in the kind of highest positions, I kind of think we always knew that maybe a Gary Neville would always come out swinging. But when the likes of kind of, you know, Amazon Prime doing a statement saying that they didn't endorse
it. That was the wishy-washiest statement of all time, though.
It was wishy-washy, but you had Gary Lineker saying he'd never work on it. I was quite pleasantly surprised to see that negative reaction, even though people might have been cutting off their nose to spite their face down the line or costing themselves work in the future. And I think that kind of fan pressure coupled with media pressure created the perfect storm that eventually meant that it couldn't go through. And as Peter says, then when governments start getting involved, then you really do have a shit storm on your hands. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to discuss Fulham's one or draw at European Super Club Arsenal. Part two of the Fulhamish podcast. It's Sammy here with Jack Collins.
Hello, listeners.
And Peter Rutzler.
Hello, hello.
So whilst Fulham got their credible draw at ESL Club Arsenal on Sunday, Peter, all of this news was actually breaking around us. I think it was Martin Ziegler in the Times who kind of made the very first comment or the first leak that this was about to happen, which was at just after one. Fulham then kicked off against Arsenal at 1:30, and this was all kind of breaking around us. But maybe us as Fulham fans weren't noticing because we were severely engrossed in this game at the Emirates. I mean, it was torture, wasn't it? Fulham somehow got themselves in the lead, and then we tried to hold on for 30 minutes, and it very much wasn't Fulham managing the game. It was very much Fulham holding on for dear life by their fingernails. And in the end, in the 97th minute, it slipped. And we've talked about Wolves being a bitter pill to swallow, Villa being a really horrible one too, but this just topped the lot, didn't it? They say things come in threes. Well, this was very much the final, what feels like nail in the coffin, but it certainly was the kind of final straw in terms of Fulham folding late.
Yeah, it was really grim.
Can I just say before we start, this game feels like an absolute lifetime ago. I know you just said it was when it was breaking on Sunday, but just thinking back, I've actually genuinely thought it was a Friday game or early Saturday, but it wasn't, was it? It happened at the same time. And yeah, as you say, I mean, talk about worst of the lot. I mean, that's the biggest kick in the teeth I think we've had over these past three games. Similar sort of issue again with the collapsing late, and I know we'll talk about that, but it was a real blow, and you could see it. I know we've seen it in the emotions. We've seen Lamina's tears, and you know, there's Parker's reaction after the Wolves goal with Adama Traore's shot. But this was a painful one, and you could see. I mean, Scott Parker afterwards, again, you know, he gets very passionate about refereeing decisions and the rules of the game sometimes, and he was very much unhappy with the potential offside at the end, which, by the letter of the law, I think, you know, to be honest, it's a legitimate goal. I think there's probably a case to be made, but it felt a bit clutching, when especially when VAR had gone so much in Fulham's favour in the game. And and just the nature of that goal, the timing. I mean, 7 minutes as well, I think that would have been more of a grievance for me. I don't know where the 7 minutes came from, but Fulham just fell back on their own goal. It just collapsed too deep, and ultimately were punished for it.
Yeah, as I mentioned,
go on.
As I mentioned, Jack, it really wasn't like Fulham got themselves in the lead and then were really able to kind of manage this game professionally. It was just hold on for dear life and pray. And that's not, I can see the tactics of like managing the game, keep it really tight, get a goal and then see it out. Yes, you're always going to have the chasing team creating a chance or two, but it was relentless from Arsenal, and Fulham really were panicking in the moment, weren't they? There was nothing cool or composed about what Fulham were doing. And we saw that later on with Loftus-Cheek's miscontrol and then Bobby Decker-Dover-Reed inexplicably letting it go out for a corner when just someone shouting, "Time, Bobby," would probably have meant Fulham could have walked away with all 3 points.
Yeah, and this is the stuff that starts to go against you when you're panicking, right? This is what happens. These are the nature of things, and we've seen it over the last 3 weeks in its kind of purest form, I think. Look, we were on the full time afterwards, and I was on with the Cooper brothers, and it was almost just like, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. It did feel a bit like all the comments were slating Bobby Reed, and I think Bobby Reed's been pretty good this season, if I'm honest. Obviously, it was a terrible mistake to put it out for a corner, and it's cost us in this game. But like on the whole, he's worked incredibly hard. Like Ruben Loftus-Cheek's miscontrol was awful. In fact, it was a terrible cameo, and I've done a lot of defending of Loftus-Cheek on this podcast over the course of the year. I think he's got more stick than he's maybe deserved a little bit at times, but not in this case. I'm not sure what he was doing, you know, when he came on. I don't think he made a positive touch on the ball. It was really, really poor. And the weird thing is, you know, if we weren't in the situation we were, and if it didn't play out the way we were, if we went a point away at Arsenal, you'd probably be like, yeah, not bad. But it is. And the fact that we've dropped 4 points now in two games, we would be, you know, 2 points behind Burnley. Yeah, albeit they'd have a game in hand, sure. But we'd be 2 points behind them, three behind Brighton. And it just felt, you know, it just feels like these things are slipping away when perhaps other teams have weirdly been dragged back into it. And we thought that Burnley and Brighton were probably good. You know, we thought they were probably safe. They've been dragged back in through a series of misfortunes of their own. We've picked up, you know, a couple of points. Newcastle have flown away from it. And as that happened, I think everyone was like, well, that's that then. But simultaneously, you've seen Burnley and Brighton drop. If we had picked up these points, we were 2 points behind Burnley. I feel like Fulham would be like, hang on, we've got to win with a real shot here. We've got Burnley to play. Like there's a lot going on in this league that you'd imagine with six games to play, 2 points behind, you'd be like, we've got a real, real shot here. And I think 5 points behind is still not impossible, but it's going to be very, very difficult.
I guess this weekend will show us what Fulham have to play with. We've been talking about the fact that Fulham have been a game ahead, two games ahead in some cases for such a long time. Fulham don't have the game this weekend. We're going to be watching a lot of football with bated breath this weekend. I mean, we all probably accept that it's over, but you might as well stick on a game if there's a chance. There's always still a 1% chance that Fulham could climb themselves out of it. And I guess when we go into next weekend's game against Chelsea, this time next week, we'll know exactly what we've got to play with here. We've got these five games. Everyone's going to be pretty much on equal games. And then we can analyse, okay, this is what Fulham have to do. Unlikely, but this is what we have to do if we're going to have a chance.
Yeah, I mean, those games in hand have been a real pain, haven't they? It makes it very, very difficult to really know where you sit, and just also annoying when you're trying to work out past precedents and everything. And it's, yeah, so it'd be nice to have that sort of clarity about what's coming in the weeks ahead. But I agree with Jack in terms of how much we've been seeing missed opportunities all season. I think, this isn't just related to the recent games. Obviously, these have been more painful. They're certainly the most painful of the campaign and how they sort of panned out, maybe West Ham and the Panenka aside. But, you know, it's a cumulative thing, and it's consistently happened throughout the season. And you do wonder, you know, you look at the squad and there's no doubting the belief in that team and the fight that they've shown, and the fact they keep coming back and they're going toe-to-toe, they're giving everything they've got. You do wonder just the fact that they are so young, in terms of Premier League experience in particular, and how much that is now playing a part, because it's in those moments, in those real heat moments where the pressure's on, where things are won and lost, where you're holding on to a tight 1-0 advantage, that you need your big players to stand up, your voices to shine through. And you can be a fantastic player, you can do everything, but if you're not equipped to fight in that situation, then You know, it becomes harder, and it becomes harder when it consistently happens because you don't have a positive message to reinforce it. You don't have a positive example. So, I think a lot of Fulham fans probably felt that something was coming, and what they felt like that against Wolves, certainly. And, it's difficult. And as Jack said, you know, it would have been a tight points gap. You know, with Burnley still to play, Burnley have had a poor season, certainly by their standards. And, you know, there's been talk, you've still got new ownership coming now, but there's always been a lot of talk about what Sean Dyche wants to do at the end of this season. And, maybe you could have there could have been a swing there, but this weekend's important. This weekend's important because if you know, even West Brom, of course, have a game in hand, and they could leapfrog Fulham and make things even more difficult. So, you know, it's everything as has been said for a while. They're all must win games, but at least we'll have some clarity now on just exactly how much of a challenge it would be and how much of a miracle it would be if Fulham can get themselves out of it.
Yeah, the games this weekend are of interest, really. West Brom have two games. They've played tonight. Maybe by the time you've listened to it, it might have happened. Away at Leicester, and then on Sunday, they go to Villa to make up their two games on us. Burnley travel to Wolves away, which you would say is a winnable game for Burnley, given how Wolves have been pretty poor recently. Even in the game against us where they did win, they were pretty poor, and they only just beat a Sheffield United side. Speaking of Sheffield United, they host Brighton, and then I guess another big one is Newcastle travelling to Liverpool.
I think Newcastle are out of it. Like, I genuinely, I can't believe I'm saying this. I think Newcastle are out of it.
I actually don't think they're out of it, Jack. That's the mad thing. If Fulham put together a run of wins, without Fulham putting together a run of wins, they're all out of it. But I actually think if Fulham do put...
Or if West Brom put together a run of wins.
I think because of that Newcastle-Fulham game on the last game of the season, I think if Fulham pulled together a run of wins, and given the tough fixtures Newcastle have, I don't think they're 100% out of it.
Okay, fair enough. That is a reasonable take. Very reasonable, in fact.
But... yeah, I mean, it's not much to analyse really here, Jack, but other than that, but you'd say that that game, Burnley against Wolves, actually, if there is one to keep an eye on, that probably is the one.
Yeah, of course. It's the kind of joker in the pack, isn't it now? If Burnley continue their slide, that is the I suppose, with Burnley to play, they're probably the team that Fulham can, you know, lock sights on, if they can lock sights on anyone. But I think it's going to revolve around Fulham getting maybe three wins out of five, which is not impossible given the caliber of fixtures that Fulham have remaining, and the fact that Chelsea and Man United may well have European commitments in the middle of theirs. Obviously, Chelsea will be halfway through a European semi against Real Madrid when Fulham play them. And if United qualify, Fulham will play them, I think, if I'm not mistaken, 4 days before the Europa League final. So, you know, it's not impossible that those teams might be rotating. They might be, especially United, might be well safe within a Champions League place and looking for silverware. You might see a heavy rotation there, considering that Solskjaer has failed to rotate through quite a lot this year, and we've seen them drop off energy-wise at certain points. So look, it's open for debate, but I think if these teams around us, if Burnley win this weekend, if Brighton win this weekend, if West Brom win this weekend, then we might have to, you know, we're going to have to pull ourselves a miracle to get out of it. And look, I'm an optimist by nature, but I think that might put the nail in my coffin if they all win this weekend.
All right, we'll leave it there, and we'll be back in a second. Part three of the Fulhamish podcast is Sammy here with Peter and Jack. So on Sunday, Fulhamish's special documentary on the 2000-2001 champions under Jean Tigana is going to be released. You can listen advert free on the Athletic app, or you can get it on your podcast app of choice. We've got some great names in there. Sean Davis, John Collins, Barry Hales, Kit Simons, all featured in conjunction with the written piece that Peter did last week in the Athletic, which you can read now if you subscribe. I'm really, really excited to release it and get it out there into the world. Obviously, Peter had done a lot of the legwork with some of these interviews. And Jack, I know you're very jealous that Peter managed to have 30 minutes with John Collins.
Yeah, one of my all-time heroes. I love John Collins. And obviously, he wore Collins 10 on the back of his shirt when I basically started watching the club. And when I, well, not started watching, but the first zones I remember of the club. And he was part of that. And then he got to introduce Collins John, which is the greatest moment, I think, in Fulham history. Exit John Collins, enter Collins John. But yeah, one of those players that I've always had, you know, an incredible soft spot for. He has links everywhere. But also, I remember, I think one of the first videos, I suppose, I ever had was the goals of the 98 World Cup, and he scored a penalty against Brazil in the opening match for Scotland. And so, yeah, it's always been one of those things. I was like, oh, I love that guy. Absolutely love that guy. So I'm jealous you got to spend some time with him.
He's a lovely guy, a really lovely guy. And he speaks really well on that season as well. It's quite clear that, you know, I mean, after such a career that he's had, it left some really powerful memories for him. Really enjoyed his time at Fulham, and especially that season, and working under John Tigana again, of course, after working under him in France. So, really lovely guy. So, sorry, I got to meet him. You didn't, Jack.
one day, back when we're in real world, I might get to meet him. You never know your luck. But Sammy, you do a lovely job on these documentaries. I don't blow, you know, smoke up your ass very often, but the last one, The Unforgettable, was absolutely sensational. So I'm really excited to listen, actually.
Oh, thank you very much, Jack. Checking the post, as they say. One thing before we finish, we didn't talk about in the first part the potential sanctions of the Super League. I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts are. I know there are a few optimistic fans out there who are looking at some kind of 30-point deduction for Arsenal might mean that Fulham are safe. We could do a Barnsley last season in the Championship where we're saved by a points deduction and keep our place in the league. Jack, what do you see the sanctions being for those clubs that did very much break away, and I assume they've broken some rules. Do you think there will be any punishment?
I don't know what rules they have actually broken. That doesn't mean that there won't be punishments. Obviously, I think the sanctions have already started, and I actually think that the nature of the sanctions that we're already seeing are going to be the nature of what they are. I think there's going to be massive pushback from the Premier League, who have already stripped a lot of the big six executives of their positions on key stakeholding positions. There was a whole review into the Project Big Picture thing that basically was supposed to concede a few things to the top six clubs in order to, like, basically keep them happy. That's going to be scrapped. I think there will be pushback in UEFA about these Champions League reforms. I think they're the sanctions we're going to see. I mean, I'm a bit conflicted on this. I do think there's a level of, you know, when you look at FFP reductions and points deductions in that the players and fans aren't the ones who cause that. But I do also think that the players and fans don't kick back against FFP reductions in you know, and punishments in the way that fans and players kicked back against this, which leaves it in a slightly murky ballpark as to, you know, where the punishments should lie. I understand the calls for points deductions. I think that when someone made a point and said, look, if one club goes into administration, they get a points deduction. What's the plan for trying to administrate 86 clubs? And I think that there's a point to be made with that, but I also am reticent to believe that they'll do it. And I think it is going to be sanctions at executive level that we really see here.
I mean, Peter, a 20-point deduction for Arsenal, they would have a game in hand, but Fulham would climb out of the relegation zone. And Arsenal's running is not the easiest, as they say. So, I mean, things I'd love to see is that it's not going to happen, but I would love to see it.
We'd love to see it. I think, similar to Jack, really, I'm there's two sides of it. There's what I think should happen and then what's probably going to happen. And I think the bottom line is the Premier League are not going to want to hit back too hard because, you know, it's you know, cut your nose to spite your face a little bit in that the big six are very important to the Premier League and the broadcast revenues and all of that side of things. And it just means that they probably will peddle the argument about focusing on the executives and targeting the individuals behind it. But as Jack says, you know, what is the difference to a team going into administration and suffering a points deduction? You know, they brought the game into disrepute. They brought the Premier League into disrepute. For me, they should have a points deduction. And I'm not just saying that because of, you know, the Fulham perspective. And you say, well, maybe they could.
They're not going to get a 20 points point deduction.
No, it wouldn't be that extreme. But even if they did, I think they would probably do it for next season. But I really, there has to be some kind of punishment for it. I cannot see how you can do something like this, jeopardize the entire pyramid, in fact jeopardize the game itself in a way by having to break away from everything and just get away with it, really. I mean, you can dismiss the people behind it, you can target the individuals behind it. But it has to be a precedent. There has to be a deterrent. I think from a European side, it's important in particular. UEFA have been absolutely shafted in terms of wanting to put through these reforms to please these groups of players. Those reforms should be cycled back. The coefficient slots should be binned. They're horrible anyway. They shouldn't really be there in the first place. You would think there would be some kind of European ban, at least for a season. There is, in the case of financial mismanagement, that is on the table. But as Jack says, what rules have they specifically broken? And that's where it will break down, and that's where it become murky. And realistically, as much as the other 14 clubs will be angry, and I'm sure the ones in the vicinity of the top six, the ones pushing into that bracket, West Ham, Everton, Leicester, will really want to push for some kind of points deduction because it benefits them. I just don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, there's been reports come out this morning that UEFA actually don't really have the power to sanction people and coming out of a Spanish court, and that even if the UEFA disciplinary committee decided to, which they could, they are the only people that basically could sanction them, that the Court for Arbitration for Sport could overturn it. I don't think we're going to see anything this season.
No.
I think this is going to rumble on.
And then you move it on to a point where you say, well, can rules be put in place where there is a punishment mechanism?
Well, this is it. There's talk of a binding agreement that they can't join a competition that's not ratified already by the FA, as in it would have to be a UEFA competition or a FIFA competition for clubs to join it. And if they did, that would be a binding, basically this would be a binding legal contract. I think that's what's being talked about right now. And that makes sense, at least as a future kind of deterrent to being able to break off from this.
I guess, Jack, one extra dangling carrot: if all of the English clubs in the top six are banned from European competition next season, it will obviously go down the Premier League, and with a UEFA Conference League launching potentially next season, not only could safety be achieved by five wins, but maybe an unlikely spot into the new competition. And now, wouldn't that be a glorious end to the season that we could all get on board
with? We could all get on board with that, Sammy. I'm in. Sold. You've made a sale.
All right. Well, thank you for listening today. A bit of a weird one with kind of Fulham not having a game in the weekend, but everyone else having one. It feels like an international break, but it's very much not.
At least there was a lot to talk about.
Yeah. I mean, without the Super League, we would have been struggling today. So, thank you, Florentino Perez, for saving the Fulhamish podcast, if little else, today. We, as I said, will be releasing the special documentary on Sunday about the 2000-2001 team. And the next Thursday, myself, Jack and Peter should be back, although everyone's moving house this week. So who knows who's going to be on next Thursday's podcast. We've got people not with internet in their houses, all sorts of logistical problems to overcome next week. So who the Thursday club is next week, you'll have to wait and find out. Good luck, both of you, with your upcoming moves this weekend. And thanks for the podcast. Peter, thank you.
No, thank you, Sammy. Thank you very much. And thanks for the nice words about my move. And I'm sure I'll have internet via my phone at least from sunny Wandsworth. So.
You're moving closer to the cottage.
The love
affair continues between Peter Rutzler and Fulham Football Club.
It's pulling me closer, Sammy. It's pulling me closer. I'm looking forward to my walks down the Thames.
And one man's moving further away, Jack Collins.
Not very far, though. Just a couple of stops down the district line. I've always been west. I'm just diving a little bit further west. It's nothing to complain about. Over to Hamworth.
Good luck with the move, and thank you for today.
Thank you very much, mate. I really appreciate it.
All right. We will be back next Thursday. And don't forget about that documentary on Sunday. Have a good weekend. Hope you have some sunshine and maybe a barbecue. Come on, you Whites.
You Whites.
You Wolves.
I'm keeping that in. That's very good.